Hi, my name is Tracy. I'm the host of What's New. What's New is a show that appears on Co-op Radio here in Austin, Texas. Co-op Radio is K-O-O-P. You can find it at 91.7 FM on the local dial and at koop.org. There at the website, you can stream the station and find out more information about our various programs, including What's New. For What's New, I try to highlight new releases, the sake of local bands, the sake of anytime somebody comes through town and tries to, that I think somebody might should know about, try to play a little bit for that. And we also have the occasional interview, and I'm very happy to have somebody that I've been wanting to speak with for a while, here in our studios at Co-op's, Mr. Gerard Costloy. How are you doing?
Doing great, Tracy. I feel weird being on a program called What's New because I'm not particularly new, but I'm very, very, very happy to be here. Thank you.
I will say, when I was pitching my show, I had 6 months of hemming and hawing and trying to figure out something like a radio related, Sonic Dimensions or something like that. But everything I could come up with was already taken. So I went with probably the most generic name I could possibly come up with for a music show. But it lends itself well. I'm able to do just about anything that I want. So has had its benefits. So.
It must be nice to have that freedom.
it's worked out okay. For a volunteer radio station that's on in a program that's on 1 hour a week, it's pretty good.
Cool.
You're somebody that's been stood out in the music scene for a long time here. In part maybe it's because it's your history with Matador Records, connections to such classic bands Pavement and Sonic Youth and all those guys. But also here in Austin you have 12XU, which have been doing great work, had the compilation albums Casual Victim Pile and things like that along it, as well as local bands the Golden Boys and such. And you also have an opinion or two. You're very funny to read and follow on Facebook. Because you have something to say every day that kind of stands out from the flotsam and jetsam of some folks who might just be going along with whatever is being currently talked about. I don't know if that's the proper way to frame that.
That's very kind of you. It's high praise to know that you're above flotsam and jetsam. maybe not flotsam and jetsam the band, but at least just actual flotsam and jetsam. I'm happy to know that I might have a little bit more to offer, but.
And you exposed me to things that I wouldn't get that I wouldn't know before otherwise. Just recently you mentioned a band that you were talking to, Saccharine Trust. Mm-hmm. And Saccharine Trust was somebody I would never have known as otherwise unless I happened to come across your feed and you were talking about it on Facebook. And is that someone's where your interest is? Because you're funny, online, I know that may not necessarily mm-hmm. be your primary job as a humorist, but
Yeah, I don't really have a real job. So persons who don't have real jobs or real families or real lives have an inordinate amount of time to mess around on social media and post links to ancient punk rock videos. I don't know if I do much more than that, really. There is stuff that I'm involved in that I hope is a little more helpful or constructive. And it's not my place to say it is or it isn't. The record labels, are still functioning, even in these days when the music industry is completely going up in flames. So I'm happy about that. That's exciting. There's a bunch of other projects I'm involved in, which are, some are better known than others. But the Facebook stuff. I'm just like anybody else. People post. Most people put photos of vacations and food and how well their children are growing up. And I find photos of a band from 1983 playing in someone's backyard.
But it's a good playing. I've come to really appreciate it because it's something that's like you said, it's like that not everybody would know about it or appreciate it. It's like, but you have that interest, and anybody that I've talked to, he knows like a wealth of music. They talk high praise. It's like about it being how, I don't know. I don't want to. It's like end up being too flowery with all this.
It's getting a little thick. I mean, I think you know. I'm like anybody else. I'm a fan. I'm a fan first and foremost, and probably at a very early age, maybe too early, I probably became a little obsessed with not simply this is the favorite song, this is a favorite record, but wanting to know a little more about where it came from, what the point of origination was. Yeah. And to this day, when I see a band that I like, whether they're established or most of the time not very established, trying to get a sense of where they came from, how they arrived at what they're doing, that's a big part of the fun. And you know, there is the whole cliche of the person who he was no longer interested in the band once they start to play in front of a couple hundred people. And I'm not saying I am that person, because I genuinely hope that the bands I like do eventually get to play in front of a couple hundred people. It would be very nice for them. But a lot of times it's the infancy period when they're beginning to play and they're beginning to find their voice and they're beginning to figure out what they want to do. Sometimes that's the most exciting stuff. Sometimes those are the moments that you're not going to see replicated ever again. And I try to keep that in mind. When it's, you know, it's a Tuesday night and I'm somewhere at 12:45 and there's like nine other people there waiting to go home. And, you know, I try to keep that in mind, because you know, sometimes the coolest stuff, the stuff that's hardest to categorize or explain later on, is going to happen in those moments when nobody's watching. And I mean, I've been very lucky. I've been very lucky to have been in the right place at the right time, over and over again for a lot of bands in multiple decades. I don't know if I'm going to be able to keep doing that upcoming decades. I think at some point, you know, something will eventually happen. Either this music will finally be banned, you know, by popular acclamation. I will finally go deaf, or you know, someone will have the common sense to say, you know, shouldn't you just go home?
Somebody pat you on the shoulder. It's like, Dad, it's time.
Hey, Granddad, we can get you a car. We can get you a ride home. No need to be here bumming everybody out. I mean, any of those things are likely to happen at some point. But until they do, I am going to keep, keep going to shows and keep, in my own way, whether it's formal or not so formal, documenting these things. And we're lucky we're in an era where you can look this stuff up. I mean, for all the other problems we have with record stores closing and print media going away, there's a lot of things to be thankful for. And the treasure trove of information that's at our fingertips, the ability to pull this stuff up and share it with people, that's pretty cool. I do like that.
Yeah, having just talking with somebody not too long ago, talking about how the advent of everything being on Spotify, everything being on YouTube videos and things like that, it's kind of like shifted the idea of where a band is discovered. It's like if a band is heard today, they're a band of today. It's like, even if they might be, it's like a band of like 30 years ago, it's like some kid comes across, it's like, and that's why you end up like with all these really cool reissue albums and some box sets and things. It's like of stuff that's being rediscovered, like Death and things like that. It's like, because somebody happens to come across it, and that's now it's like current. It's like, as opposed to 30 years old.
Okay, but at the same time, I mean, I would not be comfortable with the notion that things like YouTube and Spotify are a level playing field.
Yeah.
There's a lot of great music that's not on Spotify and probably never will be on Spotify.
Right.
You know, I mean, YouTube, it's a fluctuating thing in terms of what will or won't get taken down. There's a lot of things that have never been posted to YouTube. So, I mean, again, those things can be useful tools for people. But I would feel very, very bad if they completely replace things like going to shows, buying records, reading, talking to your friends, stuff like that. Those are also valuable ways of researching and learning about new music, old music, whatever.
Yeah, because there's something, you know, there's something to be said. It's like in the discovery process. It's like going to a record store, having somebody who's a little older said, hey, if you like that, have you heard this? And, and getting turned on to somebody is like for the first time. It's a little romantic, but it also is like it's precious.
No, I guess you could call it romantic, but I think it's pretty real. I mean, I know a ton of record stores across the country have closed, but for the good ones that still exist and the ones that are still getting their hands dirty with like being actual champions and advocates for music, even if they run the risk of being called snobs,
yeah,
you know, those are the best stores. Those are the stores that have like everything to do with pretty much what I've spent most of my life doing. So I blame them for ruining my life, essentially. but yeah, I mean, stores like that, I think are you know, incredibly important. And I think we're very fortunate to have a couple of them here in town.
Yeah, that's true. It's like, you know, Waterloo Records is kind of like the lion's share, it's like of national acclaim, but we also have the End of an Ear, it's like Trailer Space Records, it's like and Breakaway Records, and Duns, and about a dozen more. It's like that I can rattle off. It's like that that do the neighborhood record shop business well. It's like, and people drive across town. It's like just to see those wares. It's like for yourself. You know, you have like 12XU. It's like a great label here in town that just as like recently has been putting out good stuff by local bands like Fleshlights, Jonely Bonely. It's like who's been doing. I've been hearing good things. It's like over this past 3 weeks. It's like a lot of folks. It's like being turned on to them. It's like catching them for the very first time. It's like what was some of the impetus? It's like for doing 12XU, and how did that kind of come to be? It's like to what it is now.
Well, the label started in 2001, and at the time I was living and working in London, and was still, you know, I mean, as much like today, still one of the co-owners of Matador and involved in the operation of that vaunted gigantic record label. you know, at that point, Matador was pretty established, much like now, and. It's a tricky thing is when you have a partnership, and Matador is a partnership. It's a partnership between four people. It's hard to find a consensus sometimes. And when there's a project that's really sort of initiated by one person and the other three aren't really into it, it doesn't necessarily succeed. You know, yeah. I mean, it might against all odds, but chances are the deck might be stacked against that particular artist. So at that point in time, it was becoming kind of clear to me that there were a number of things I wanted to do that were not going to fit on Matador for a variety of reasons, sales expectations, issues of taste, whatever, you know, things that I just felt, you know, had to come out because they were good, that, you know, within the confines of a label that has to meet a minimum sales level. just to keep the doors open and keep everybody swimming in drugs and fur coats, it would be very, very hard to do those records on Matador. As I'm very fond of telling people, with Matador we can do whatever we want to do,
right?
But we can't do everything we want to do. And on the moments in history when we have tried to do everything we wanted to do, and you don't, I mean, you can look it up. There were years that we put out 35 records. How many of those records bombed? It wasn't because the records weren't good. It's because we just literally did not have the time and space to devote, you know, enough attention to each one of them. But, you know, it's a different world now. I mean, back when Matador began, there were certain projects that I think we felt if we ourselves did not get involved, those records weren't ever going to come out. I think we really believed that at the time, and I think it was true. Conversely, there are so many more labels working within those genres now that are very good at what they do and do a very good job of doing what Matador did 25 years ago, that's not so much the case. I mean, Matador doesn't have that same sort of relationship to the culture anymore. And that's not a knock on the label. I think it's just how things have come to be.
Yeah.
Whereas 12XU, which is a one person operation, there's very little pretense of it being a professional, ambitious, commercially relevant label, that's much more about documentation and getting things out there and helping people, I guess, sort of get their start. Although, weirdly, there are a lot of older veteran bands on the label. But, yeah, at the time in 2001, there were a number of projects that, for one reason or another, were not going to work on Matador. And I thought, well, let's try this instead. Let's try this other label instead. And it was tough because at the time I was based in London. The records were coming out in Europe. With one exception, these were all records by American-based artists. It was difficult. The marketplace over there at that time was not super receptive to those artists. We did not sell many records. It was really a bit of a struggle. It's the only record that really did well at the time was probably the fourth Spoon album, which did very well in Europe. And then, you know, ushered in their very, very brief return to Matador on Matador Europe for one album. But yeah, the other stuff didn't do so well, which is disappointing. And I moved back to the U.S. in 2004 with the intention of continuing to do the label. But things kind of slowed down at that point.
Yeah.
You know, I really was just contending with a garage full of unsold CDs and records, just trying to wonder.
All this stock.
Yeah. Boy, this stuff's going to be following me around the world, following me around the world forever.
In every garage that you ever go have a house, yeah, it's like going to be stacks and stacks.
Yeah. So I was kind of thinking of kind of had a mind of maybe wrapping it up.
Yeah.
And, you know, I probably for a brief period of time kind of lost the bug, as it were. And it was really after being here for a while and seeing a lot of the better new bands here in town and seeing some of the bands in Denton and becoming more conversant with what was happening with a lot of newer, or at least newer to me, American punk labels, that I began thinking, you know, there needs some of this stuff, it's got to come out or no one's going to know it ever happened.
Right.
And yeah, I mean, seeing a lot of shows at, you know, at places like Beerland and, you know, places like Beerland, places like the old Emos, places like, whatever. I'm not going to rattle off a list of places,
yeah.
but
I'm trying to think. It's like, you know, there's a couple of places that have no longer with us anymore.
The Broken Neck for sure.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, yeah, you know, this is pretty exciting. And, you know, there is this element of like, hey, Columbus discovered America. You know, it's like none of that stuff was actually new. It was new to me.
Right.
It was new to me as somebody who'd been living in another country and did not have a really close relationship to what was happening with DIY records in America. I had to kind of refamiliarize myself with stuff that I probably knew like the back of my hand 15 years earlier.
Yeah.
But it was definitely a big blind spot for me, probably between say like 2000, 2006.
Well, that's interesting because it's like, I always thought it's like, you know, it's like the stories of SST and all this other stuff. It's like in Merge and things like that. There'd be like this kind of, yeah, it's like, you know, a band gets together, they put out a label and they make a 7-inch or something like that. And they just do it whatever they need to. It's like to make that happen. It seems interesting. It's like to refamiliarize yourself. It's like, you're just like, oh yeah, it's like, this is how this is. Because it's like, to me, that romanticized history is like of independent publishing on that type of stuff. It's like, it's been there. I don't know. It's like but I guess it's like getting re-exposed to it and it's like and getting back and finding initiative to be a part of that.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely felt re-energized. I mean, being in Austin was a big kick in the ass for me in terms of, you know.
Was there any particular bands at that time where you're saying it's like, all right, I need to record these guys? It's like
I mean, other people were recording them. I mean, yeah. It would be really presumptuous of me to be like, oh, I found this, I found that. There were already tons of people here who were making really good records with those bands and doing amazing work with them. So, I mean, I'm absolutely a latecomer, you know, compared to people like Richard Lynn, compared to people like Timmy Hefner, You know, compared to Mark Twistworthy, you know, I'm very much like a latecomer here who's like, hey, check it out. Those are bands. Isn't that novel?
yeah.
So, I'm not, you know, there's nothing super special about me seeing great rock and roll bands and saying, hey, let's make a record. There were already guys doing that, and they continue to do it and do it very well. But yeah, I mean, there were definitely bands here, you know, I mean, definitely, you know, befriending the Golden Boys was a big part of it. You know, seeing the Young for the first time, all the times I saw the Markmen, and that's a band that was already, you know, three albums in before I saw them for the first time. I know for a lot of people, it's like, yeah, well, whatever. Those bands were around forever. They weren't around forever for me. For me, it was like, wow. Yeah. Where did this come from? And then it's like, what? You know, you want to find out more. You want to find out more about where it came from. Who else do they play with? What other bands have they been in before? What other bands in other cities are relevant to this? And then before you know it, it's a huge rabbit hole.
Yeah.
You know, and it's fun. It's fun to learn about that stuff. And there was a certain culture of bands playing in town, say circa 2008 or so, that I really liked, that I felt, for one reason or another, we're not really going to get a shot. You know, the way things were working here with, you know, the more established local media, which really, in my estimation, seemed to be very, very biased towards more kind of singer-songwriter stuff, the Americana stuff.
Yeah, that's come up.
The more country-inflected stuff, which, you know, I think, you know, historically, you know, there's so much of that music in this town, and some of it's very, very good. But I really felt as though there was sort of like this built-in sort of like Dan with faint praise, like these bands that play at these places in this neighborhood, they're cute and everything, but they're never going to go that far. Mm. And I found that frustrating because, to my mind, they were as exciting as anything else I saw going on. So I came up with the idea for that that first Casual Victim Pile record on Matador, which was a really fun record to work on. It was a really fun project, and I had a really great time doing it. It didn't do that well.
It didn't
sell that well.
Was it just because it was Austin-centric?
I think around the rest of the country, it got a handful of good reviews. But, I mean, it did not really sell. And even locally, some of the coverage, people were like, well, how come Yellow Fever aren't on the record? You know, it's like, well, gee, I don't know. Why don't you put out your own compilation, and then you can tell me who's good, you know? So, there was a bit of that, like sort of like, why isn't so-and-so on the record? It's like, you know, I'm not trying to document the entire landscape of Austin music. That's not what I'm doing. I'm just saying, this is the stuff I like. These are the bands I think have something interesting going on. Some of them have things in common, others don't. But I certainly wasn't trying to say this is the be-all and end-all of Austin music. But anyway, I mean, yeah, that was a fun record. And then after, it really, like almost immediately after that record came out, bands on that record started breaking up left and right. and even before the record came out, bands were breaking up left and right, and other bands were forming. These other bands were forming who were, some of them were even better. And I remember, like around the time we're finishing, you know, the first Casual Victim Pile record and seeing like the OBN3s and seeing Cruddy for the first time, it's like, wait a second. Can we just stop? let's make it a triple record. Let's stop the presses. What are we gonna do?
But so, that was just part of the Austin thing. It's like,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
you play in a band until you don't feel like it, and then you make another band.
Yeah.
It's nothing. There was no any real singular reason for any of that. It just kind of like just the way the
in some cases you had expats from other places.
You wouldn't have
the OBN3s, and you wouldn't have a Giant Dog without North Texas, and you wouldn't have them without Houston. So
okay.
that's a huge part of it. And you wouldn't have the Fleshlights without San Antonio. So that's a big part too. But
a lot of people that I know, it's like, who play in bands, play in like 15 different bands because they want to constantly be playing music, and they can't just get their main bands like on every bill every night of the week.
Yeah.
So that's how they keep into the scene.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's if you're good at it, it's fun. Yeah. If you're not so good at it, it probably isn't so much fun. But yeah, I mean, that's how the second Casual Victim Pile record came about that way. Well, there's this other stuff.
Yeah.
Now there's this other, you know, new wave of, if you'll excuse the cliche, and another wave of interesting bands. And at the time, it was like, you know, I mean, we could try to do it on Matador again, but it'll be kind of expensive. It'll probably meet the same reaction. Oh, cute, Austin Garage Rock, whatever. And I thought maybe it would make more sense just to take this out of the realm of Matador and do it individually just on 12XU, because the infrastructure is still there.
Yeah.
We still have a website, still have a PO box, still have a label logo. I still know who to call to get a record mastered. It's how hard could it be?
Being one person, you know, it's like you had to do a lot of heavy lifting, but at the same time, it's like you knew who was doing it.
Yeah. So, I mean, that record came together, and again, it was not a massive seller, but I'm pretty happy with the record itself and how it was received. And, you know, again, you want to talk about a rabbit hole. I mean, really, kind of like after that record got done, I began to think again. It's like, well, you know, now that this thing exists, now that 12XU actually exists again, it would kind of be a shame just to put it away. Why stop now? Why quit now? And it was, I mean, really, at that time, Cruddy were, in my estimation, probably the best live band in town.
Yeah.
They probably would have eventually made a record with somebody else. I mean, I'm not, again, it would be really foolish of me to say that I'm the only person who could have done it, because a lot of people could have done it. But to me personally, it was very, very important that that record come out and look right and sound right. And that kind of got the ball rolling. It was sort of like after that record came out and began to generate attention, a lot of other people who I knew and liked began coming to me and saying, well, hey, why don't we do this? Why don't we do that? And it kind of steamrolled from there. And in the 3 or 4 years since, a lot of the older artists who were on the label the first time around,
yeah,
back in the prior decade, have now come back to make records, which is really cool. You know, there've been artists from other parts of the world. It's funny to put out records by people from, you know, Australia and New Zealand and Western Canada, far off Western Canada. So I do bristle a little bit if anyone characterizes it as an Austin label, because
yeah.
Though the majority of the records are, you know, Austin related, I mean, our top seller last year was a band from Pittsburgh.
Oh.
The band that's gotten the most press out of anyone on the label so far is an artist from Cleveland, Ohio. So, I'm not pretentious enough to call it a national record label, but I don't really consider it a local label either.
How do these far off bands find you? Did they just know you from past stuff? It's like working with you and say, hey, I've been shopping this around. Would you want to get a look at it?
Yeah, I wouldn't really call it shopping it around. I mean, these are conversations. These are conversations you have with friends, with people that you know.
Right.
I mean, the artist from Cleveland would be Opnox, Bim Thomas, and I mean, I've known Bim for a couple of decades now. He was one of the early drummers in the Bassholes, who, in addition to their great records on In the Red, had an early record on Homestead. So I mean, I've known Bim off and on for a pretty long time, and have followed other bands he's been in since then, and. So yeah, it's not really like a scouting thing. It's not like I'm like some sort of like, you know, yeah, like A&R person who's like traveling across the country, watching people play and scratching my chin trying to determine whether or not they're the right fit or some nonsense like that.
Prevailing image of like the old record industry stuff that still kind of exists. I gotta say.
I mean, I'm sure it exists somewhere. It definitely doesn't exist with me. These are people who, you know, again, I mean, I consider them friends. And, you know, that was again, just the conversation. You know, yeah, he had a record on the Cleveland label Smog Veil that had gone out of print and said, hey, do you want to take this record over and repress it? and that was like 8 records ago. he's very prolific. The Pittsburgh band, they're called the Go to Beds.
Yeah.
And their debut record, Poor People Are Revolting, did pretty well last year, and now they're off on their way to a much bigger, better record label in Seattle. Good for those guys. That's my dream, by the way. If everybody on 12XU could just leave and go to the bigger batter label in Seattle. Not only would I get my life back, and I could put things in my house other than boxes of records, but I could be at home right now watching TV. You know, it'd be great. But yeah, they're called the Go to Beds. They're from Pittsburgh, and two of those guys were in a Pittsburgh band called Kim Fuck, who I was a fan of, and they did a session on Terry T's program on WFMU about a year and a half ago that I was lucky enough to hear. Cool. And a couple of days after the session, they sent me a CDR of the session as though I hadn't heard it before. I'm like, hey, we want to do a single. We want to do a single. It's like, great, yeah, singles. That's a money dump. Thank you for being kind enough to ask me to put out a single that's going to be a complete waste of money. Let's do an album instead. And we did. And it turned out great. They're a super exciting band, and I'm really, really happy for those guys now that they've left me in the dust for a big, 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 big record label in Seattle.
Well, with you know, like you say, like we were talking about, it's like some of the bands that's like that've been doing well. It's like Fleshlights, Johnny Bonely, mm-hmm. Spray Paint. Is that kind of like the?
Yeah, I'm sorry to nitpick. I actually have no working relationship with Spray Paint. They're not on my label.
Oh, okay.
I'm a huge fan of those guys, and I consider them friends sometimes. But I'm kidding. They are friends. But yeah, they're not on 12XU. We would be.
Okay.
We would be.
Yeah, you're right.
We'd be lucky to have them, but they're not on the label.
Yeah, it's like I guess it's like I was looking at Sweet Talk. It's like it was not necessarily Spray Paint, but it's like. But for those bands, it's mm-hmm. is in the relationship between 12XU and Matador. I know it's like not official, but is there, like.
There's no relationship.
Okay.
There's no.
Right.
The only relationship would be that Matador owns a direct distribution company in New York that sells records to mom and pop stores across the country.
Okay.
And 12XU is one of the labels that sells records on consignment to that distribution company. But we do the same thing with a number of other small distribution companies around the United States. Matador isn't even the second highest seller for us of those distribution companies. So yeah, I mean, that's the extent of the relationship. Matador, okay. Does not own any portion of 12XU. The company does not involve itself with the marketing and promotion of 12XU as any of the bands, could probably tell you much to their frustration.
They might call you up and say, hey, how come this isn't happening? And it's like going, oh, well, it's like, I need to let you know this.
hey, you don't like it? You don't like it? Write to somebody in Seattle.
Well, I guess it's like, you know, some folks that's like on the outside would just assume it's like, you know, it's like, all right, it's like AAA ball, major leagues. It's like, you know, 12XU,
well, you know,
it's like as a farm.
You know something? I mean, it's not like that. It's not like that.
Yeah.
I mean, nobody on 12XU has been, quote unquote, upstreamed to Matador, and Matador doesn't have a unilateral right to do something like that. They would have to go to those artists. I mean, just to be very clear, the records on 12XU, I don't own the copyright on them. The artists own the copyrights. They own the publishing. They're merely leasing the sound recordings to me for like a pressing of 500 records. And if Matador wanted to do something with those bands, they would have to approach those bands and make a whole new deal with them. And I'm not sure that's ever likely to happen. I mean, it's not the furthest fetched notion of all time, but again, I mean, they're very different operations. And you're free to use the big leagues, AAA analogy if you want. I'm more comfortable with the AAA short season single A analogy, but We'll leave the sports talk for the sports bloggers out there. I think I'm uncomfortable with it because at one point in time, you wouldn't have called Matador Major League. You wouldn't have called Matador Double A. And I challenge anyone to tell me that Matador was a less relevant label when we were putting out records out of Chris's loft and stuffing sleeves by hand. I challenge anyone to tell me that it was a less relevant label then than it is now. That was important stuff that had to happen. And sometimes things grow out of that.
Yeah.
And I mean, I'm not saying the same thing will ever happen to 12XU. I kind of don't think it will. But that's not what it's about. That's not the goal. The goal is to put out the best possible stuff, help it any way we can. And for people who are hung up on like hierarchies of, hey, major labels, that's the goal. You want to be on a major label. You're missing the point. You're missing the point of the last 30 years of history. Talk to any band that's actually been signed to a major label. The vast majority of them will characterize it as the worst thing that ever happened to them. I reject the notion that getting signed to a label, whether it's 12XU or Matador or Sub Pop or Merge or Drag City, I reject the notion that that's actually an achievement. It's not an achievement. It's just, you've made an arrangement with someone else to put your record out. Doesn't make your band any better. Doesn't even necessarily make your band any bigger.
Right.
And some of the best records that are coming out right now are on labels far smaller than anyone I've mentioned, far smaller than 12XU. So,
well, there's always these horror stories. It's like of a band who gets signed and then they end up like making even less money than what they had before because of they incur all these hidden costs, like that gets tied to the mm-hmm. album, and then they go on tour for 2 years and they barely break even, and then next thing you know they're dropped, and that seems to be like a running horror story.
Yeah, and it might not happen nearly as much these days because labels don't have as much dough to throw around for advances.
Right.
So now, by the same token, the margins are much thinner.
Yeah.
So
they're relying on pretty much just something that they know that they can sell. It's like, and if a band is doing well already regionally, they might pick it up. It's like to.
Well, I mean, we're painting with broad strokes. Yeah. I mean, different labels have different goals. Different labels have different notions of what is or isn't their thing. I mean, I can't speak to what major labels are looking for.
Okay.
I don't think I ever could. On the independent level, there's no shortage of labels that are taking big chances purely because it's stuff they like, not because they think it's necessarily established. And there's even some mid-sized kind of big labels doing that. So,
yeah.
I mean, I would never in a million years suggest that, a label like Sacred Bones, a label like Captured Tracks, a label like Secretly Canadian, I don't look at them as labels that are only working on established known entities. I mean, I think they take plenty of risks.
Well, it's like, again, it's like you're dealing with this mythology of like how record labels are, like what, where we were exposed to is like in the mythology of the 80s and the 90s that still kind of permeates. It's like, even though it's like people might bemoan, it's like, the death of the music industry or something along those lines. It's like, is it actually better than what it was before? Because now it's like you have bands getting signed and getting pressed that people like. And it's that motivation as opposed to, let's see if we can get a number one hit out of this.
Again, I mean, these are big generalizations. There are still people aiming for a number one hit,
you know.
So I know, and there are some things that have changed radically, and other things that are exactly the same as they were before. So I'm not sure I can really answer that question. I mean, is it better now than it used to be? There are certainly things about right now, like this actual moment in time, for a new artist that are very, very encouraging, and we touched on that earlier with methods of distribution.
Yeah.
There are a lot of ways you can get the word out there that do not require a huge amount of money. They do not require, they don't even necessarily require having physical inventory. The flip side to that, one of the flip sides to that, is getting paid has never been harder. And, we're competing with free.
Right.
We're competing with free.
Download Spotify, things like
over,
that.
Over and over again. And, you know, we could talk for hours about Spotify. I really don't want to get into that because we could be here all day. you know, that's a totally new model that it works very, very well for record companies with deep, deep catalog. It doesn't necessarily work well for one artist putting out one record with their own money. You know, does it cannibalize sales? Does it replace airplay? These are all questions people can answer for themselves.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, I think it is much, much harder right now to actually get paid for anything.
Yeah. One success that you had this year, it's like, was The Young on Matador. Did well? It's like, or at least it's from my perspective, from what I saw, it's like, what I read, it's like,
I think the record is an artistic success.
Yeah.
You know, I would call that an artistic success. I mean, the record, I think, is absolutely amazing. I think it was one of the best records of last year. You know, I think...
And that's somebody championed on Matador.
I think Hans is an amazing songwriter. I think both he and Kyle are totally killer guitar players. I think Tim Green did a brilliant job recording that record. But I mean, you know, when you call it a success, I'll be frank. It was an artistic success. The record has not sold particularly well.
Okay.
And critically, the reactions have been mixed. And that's, I'm using the word mixed because I'm a very diplomatic person that doesn't want to call out one or two particular reviewers and threaten to curb stomp them, because I'm not that kind of person. I'm kind and loving, and I try to respect their point of view, even though they are completely wrong and have no sense of musical history and would not know a good guitar record if it hit them over the head. Hit them over the head repeatedly. Bam, bam, bam. So that's a frustrating situation. I think I don't merely think The Young are one of the best bands in Austin. I think they're one of the best bands, period. And, you know, I think this city kind of slept on them. I think the country kind of slept on them. And, you know, we'll see what happens next. We'll see what happens next with them, you know, creatively. But I do think there will be a moment in time where people are going to look back on the two records they made for Matador and the very good album they made for Mexican Summer. And people are going to be like, yeah, how did, you know, we kind of screwed up here. We kind of missed the boat on these guys.
Well, what was the deciding factors like for that particular band to say it's like, all right, Matador as opposed to 12XU, or is that just splitting hairs at that point?
Yeah, I mean, it's very rarely does that ever come up. You know, I mean, really, there's not much. I mean, you'd be surprised. I mean, there's very little discussion of which label. It just doesn't happen. You know. In the case of The Young, at the time that Matador began talking to them, 12XU was not nearly as organized and active as it is at the moment. In addition, I mean, The Young were pretty busy on their own. They had done a lot of good stuff on their own. They had made a record for another East Coast label, Mexican Summer, that had met with decent sales and decent critical acclaim. And they, at that point in time, The Young had a lot more of a foundation in place than the average band on 12XU. And in that sense, it would probably make more sense for them to be on a label that had bigger resources to pay for recording, something going on in terms of marketing and promotion. Though that hasn't really worked out so far, at least it hasn't worked out commercially. I'm not second-guessing any part of it. I feel pretty strongly that those guys were ready and deserving to make big records on a bigger label. And it's unfortunate that they haven't sold very well. But like I said, I don't second guess any part of it. I still believe in those guys 100%.
Is that just, you know, it's like the success of a record? Is it just like you're saying, just the audience is just not catching it? Is it just it's like
Well, it could be
publicity.
It could be any number of things. I mean, I'm sure there are people out there who heard those records and they weren't blown away by them, who would say, well, of course they didn't sell. They weren't very good. You know, I'm sure there's somebody who would say that. I say that myself about things all the time. I mean, we're talking about matters of opinion here.
Right.
And, you know, it's funny because, I mean, I know there are people who at least, I mean, most of them didn't say it to my face, but I know there were people who were like, well, why are these guys on Matador? Like, I don't even know who they are. And it's like, well, you don't really know the Matador history that well, because chances are there are records we put out 20 years ago by bands you didn't know who they were until we got involved with them. It doesn't happen nearly as much these days, but again, it's sort of evolved into a different type of record right. label. But I'm sorry, what was your question?
Well, I guess it's like, you know, it kind of brings up the idea because you and I kind of spurred this, like, this notion of being able to sit down this today was, it's like, in part because there was like a little discussion talking about, it's like, what does the Austin music scene need? And these are kind of like wormhole type conversations that come up every so often. And one of them was, it's like talking about publicists, infrastructure, record labels, it's like A&R guys or whatever.
Yeah.
Like, we have bands, we have labels, but it's like those type of other industry things might be in other cities like Nashville and things like that.
Yeah, but why is it so important that we have those things?
Right, and that was like your take was, that the bands are, like, are talented, they ought to be able to be successes. It's like, at least here in Austin, on the face of it, not necessarily need those guys. Is that...
Yeah, that's kind of where I'm coming from, and this is weird because I'm on your show essentially, issuing a rebuttal to someone else's take on this, and I haven't even heard the person's full rebuttal. So this is the ultimate talk radio moment when an uninformed voice can state his opinion loudly about something he knows nothing about. This is the ultimate talk radio moment.
And that's why I'm kind of like doing this as general as possible.
Okay.
It's like, you know, it's like somebody comes to you, it's like, and say, it's like, hey, it's like, you know, Austin music scene is great, except for they need X, Y, and Z, and it's all like white collar type job folks.
Okay.
Your take would be, it's like, well, no, that's just like that. That's not quite right.
Look, this is all a matter of opinion. I mean, you a couple days ago sent me a link to a piece in the Chronicle, where they discussed how Cat Edmondson, like, kind of needed to go to New York, to get proper representation and to make her career take off. And I mean, good for her. I have nothing against her. I mean, I wouldn't listen to her music on a dare, but I have nothing against her. And
more power to her.
If that's what works for her and within her genre and her career, that's terrific. For most of the bands that I know, I don't think they should be moving to New York looking for representation. You know, I don't feel like. Their lot in life as artists or people trying to earn a wage is going to be bettered by a sudden influx of PR companies moving to Austin, or entertainment lawyers setting up shop on Red River, or a whole new generation of band managers, aspiring band managers arriving in town. I'm your manager now. I'm going to take 15% of your nothing and turn it into. I don't know what I'm going to turn it into. Well, I guess we're going to find out what I'm going to turn it into. I mean,
I'll write all your tweets now. And,
I will. I am now your social media guru, and I will need 10% of your income to be your social media guru.
Did that ever happen in the 90s? It's like when we had like that big surge. It's like of stuff. It's like in .com money and all this other stuff. Did that happen previously? I was around, but I wasn't here.
I couldn't tell you because I didn't get here until I didn't move here until 2004.
Yeah,
and I certainly visited here enough times, but I didn't have the impression that Austin was chock-a-block with independent PR companies and aspiring band managers and new booking agencies and what's the other infrastructure-y thing that we're lacking.
It's like stylists.
Stylist.
A videographer.
New media consultant. I need someone to run my Instagram for me because my thumbs are so clumsy. I need someone else to post the Instagram pictures for me. I think. I'm sorry if I sound like I'm not taking this seriously because I am. This is how I talk in real life when I'm not on the radio. I guess the difference is, you know, we talk about the infrastructure, and I'm not particularly obsessed with how do we make the Austin music industry stronger.
Yeah.
I mean, I kind of don't really care about the Austin music industry. I care about the bands that are good and I care about people who are creative and doing things that are interesting and new. And I don't believe necessarily that they're going to be elevated by the Austin music industry being stronger or the Austin industry being more populated with professionals. I think we need less industry, and I think we need more fans.
Like if a band gets, you know, like Spoon or it's like Aquaville mm-hmm. River or something along those lines, it's like becomes like a more of a national landscape type band. The realism is that that's rare and that you just can't make that happen. And
I don't think it's wrong that it's rare. You know, I mean, I don't think it's terrible that it's a rare thing. I mean, we can all sit here and say, well, there's various Austin bands that I believe should be bigger worldwide. Why aren't the Young bigger worldwide?
Yeah.
Why weren't TV Torso bigger worldwide? You know, why isn't Carolyn Wonderland bigger worldwide? Well, okay, you know what? If you're going to say that, pick the international artist from somewhere else that you'd like to get smaller. Pick somebody else from another city who's doing well that you'd like to see squished down to mortal size. Because it kind of doesn't work like that. I mean, I would take the exchange. If you could say to me, okay, well, you know, let's siphon off 30,000 sales from the Black Keys and give it to the Young. I mean, sure, I'd vote for that in a heartbeat.
Yeah.
But I also know that's not how it works. It's not how people fall in love with music, how they fall in love with bands. And I kind of feel like the influence of things like PR companies, and the whole kind of pay-to-play culture. Pay-to-play culture exists in ways that are insidious, and it exists in ways that are blatant. The blatant way is like, you know, you show up at some bogus showcase at a venue on Red River that I won't mention because I think Red Eyed Fly is an awesome room, wonderful people. But if you show up there and some third party has booked some kind of weird showcasey thing, it's happening like on the Tuesday of South by Southwest. It's a faux battle of the bands of some sort,
right?
And people have paid for the privilege of taking that space on stage. That's blatant pay to play, and even a layperson knows that's lame as hell. Okay, everybody knows that's lame as hell. But conversely, the same people who would say, "Well, that pay to play thing is bad. It's bad. It's evil. It stinks."
Right.
Those are the same people who willingly, you know, chat on the phone and chat on email with PR people who are paid $2,000 and sometimes more to work a record by a band that maybe spent $700 recording the record.
And what are they doing? It's like they're calling on the phone on all the radio stations and things like that.
Well, I mean, a PR person generally doesn't work radio. There's usually a radio person doing
right,
that.
Right. Okay.
That's another fee. Usually you don't have the same person doing radio and press, not most of the time. But, I mean, yeah, this stuff adds up. And I'm not saying, for example, people don't have the right to spend their money as they see fit. People can spend their money on whatever they want. I'm just saying for the bands that I know that I think are actually making interesting music that's going to stand the test of time, these are generally not people playing the Saxon Pub, with all due respect.
Yeah.
You know, they're making records that are recorded pretty cheaply. They're spending their own money to manufacture those records and ship them around the world. It's the margins are incredibly thin as is, and now they're being told by somebody, not necessarily someone on your show, but somebody is saying to them,
yeah,
if you really want to make it, you have to give me this payment, this walking around money, as it were. You got to give me this money, and I'll make things happen for you.
It's a false premise. It's like, you know, because odds are it's like that will not come to be. It's like, you know, if you give them money, it's like they won't make you a star. It's
well,
an old
look,
adage.
I mean, I'm not saying that there's no, I'm not saying there's no correlation between independent PR and like actual, like real tangible press that's helpful and helps move things along.
Right.
You know, I mean, I'm not going to lie to you and say that Matador doesn't employ a PR person, or that we've never used an independent PR person. I'm just saying that I don't feel that of all the things that Austin, Texas, and its musicians really need, I don't think that independent PR people and band managers and entertainment lawyers, I don't think those are very high on the list of things bands are really dying for.
Well, there's a, again, talking about romanticism, there's a romanticism about the Austin music scene. And mm-hmm. I guess it's like it pays to be realistic about what all it's like the industry is. It's like, you know, we might help get people to come to town, say, for South by Southwest, but, you know, it's like the size of it and what it all can accomplish. It's like you have to be realistic about what it can do, I guess.
Yeah, I just, I mean, if, again, I know I'm coming at this from a different viewpoint than other people.
Yeah.
And I know I sound kind of disrespectful about it, but it's just like it's the constant emphasis on Austin music industry. Let's take the word industry out of it. Let's just throw it in the dumper. Let's just get rid of it. Let's concentrate as much as we possibly can on music and art and elevating the culture, and let's see what happens then. Let's see what good things come out of that. Let's see what happens when instead of throwing our money at people who are pretty replaceable in the overall scheme of things.
Yeah.
And I do think most music industry professionals, present company included, are pretty replaceable. You know, I don't think genius artists are replaceable. I don't think life-changing records are replaceable. That's what I'd like to see people focusing on more. And you know, with the whole idea of, like, you know, the town somehow desperately needs, you know, more of a defined music industry. Man, I would settle for another 30 or 40 people who were just willing to pay to get into shows. Yeah. I think that would make a big difference. I'd like to see that.
Well, you know, we kind of walked around. It's like there's, you know, this past year has been a lot of things. It's like they've been discussed. It's like artists load in sections. It's like near clubs. Mm-hmm. It's like talking about making Red River a cultural arts district. It's like to kind of help us, like, with taxation, like for the clubs and things along those, and the development that's coming in there. It's like, you know, do you see, it's like those are accessory things that impact the music and the musicians. It's like inadvertently. Mm-hmm. It's like, but again, it's like, you know, that shouldn't be the end all be all sake of where folks' interest should lie, right?
Well, I think that stuff's important. I mean, I think that there's a daily reality of, like, you know, I mean, you call it the live music capital of the world, but you can't load in for a show without getting a parking ticket.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I applaud people who are trying to address that. And I don't think that's a waste of time at all. I think that's pretty valuable. I'm not super comfortable with any organization that says they represent brands and bands in that order. I have an issue with that, because I'm not interested in the welfare of brands. I'm not interested in the welfare of my own brand.
Okay. Well, you know, we just, as we're speaking today, they just announced new safety measures. It's like for South by Southwest. It's like additional cars to be used as traffic stops. It's like to be parked as barricades.
Yeah, barricades.
I can't speak. But barricades, it's like, you know, to kind of offset some of the stuff that happened. It's like at the South by Southwest last year.
Uh-huh.
But again, it's like, you know, the big story out of 2012 or 2014 South by Southwest was talking about Doritos and Lady Gaga Gate, mm-hmm. and brands having an emphasis over the scene. And I take it as, like, you know, that's your kind of take too. It's like your brands is like coming in, it's like, and kind of piggybacking on this and making it their festival as opposed to the
music
festival.
I mean that was already in motion for a long time. You know, I mean, you drive down I-35 and there's a huge Miller billboard that says, you know, we're the official beer of South by Southwest. They can't use the name South by Southwest without paying for it.
Right.
They're a sponsor, and the whole notion that, you know, Miller would only, that a Miller or a Microsoft or a JetBlue or any number of these .coms or energy drinks or car companies or whatever, that they would pay tons of money simply to be associated with a couple of trade fairs. I don't care if it's the hippest trade fair on earth. It's not because it's a trade fair. It's because it's a trade fair that, like it or not, morphed into a music festival, even if it's a music festival that's best elements had nothing to do with the official side of things. And I don't think you can have it both ways. I don't think you can go to all that effort to turn downtown into this gigantic spring break destination
right
annually, You know, it's the cash registers going off for everybody. And then, like, when something bad happens, when somebody gets hurt, then you say, well, it's these unofficial events that are causing security problems.
Right.
You know, it's like I don't
conveniently.
Yeah. It's like, you know, no, everybody's got a hand in it. Everybody's got a hand in it. I mean, look, I was downtown the night that stuff happened. And it's absolutely terrible, but I mean, you know, I was putting on a show in that general neighborhood. So, I mean, I'm adding to the crowd. I'm adding to the whole thing. It's not just South By's fault. It's everybody's fault.
Is there any solution, or is this just a thing that you manage now? It's like, you know, this big thing that happens. It's like every year. Do you have like any two bits? It's like on.
Yeah, I mean, it would be pretty inappropriate of me. I don't.
Is it better to just kind of like, all right, I'm going to go do my own thing and do something completely different? Like,
it depends on what you want, you know. I mean, it's a tough one to answer. I mean, I don't want to make it sound as though I'm holding. I mean, when I refer to bad things happening, for example, I'm talking about, you know, the Strokes gig at Auditorium Shores when the fences came down.
Right.
That was an official South By event when you had. That poor guy got conked on the head with the camera boom,
right,
at the Orchestral Maneuvers in the Dark show, and now he can't practice law anymore because his brains are scrambled. That was an official South By show. When you had the incident at the Screeching Weasel show at the Scoot Inn, that was another South By show. So these are all prominent events.
Not just 2014.
These are official events. And they've all got different sorts of crowd control issues because it's not just a trade fair, because it appeals to everybody. The entire world wants to be in town that week. So you can't just say, well, it's a trade fair. But I want to make it very clear. I do not hold South By or its organizers responsible for what happened in front of the Mohawk last year.
Yeah, I think most – well, I can't say everybody, but it's like I'd like to think it's like most folks that like see it for when you have that many people, you have that many things going on, something may happen, and I like to think that that's how that happened. It wasn't necessarily it's like negligence, it's like, or anything along those lines. It was just circumstantial.
Well, look, I mean, you know that there's going to be a certain number of people in a public space. So you take certain precautions. And I'm not saying they didn't take the right precautions, but it's something that you review. And if you go to any big city around the world when they're planning a major event, whether it's a Super Bowl, right, or a World Cup or a papal visit, I'm really not making – I mean, we're talking about a tragedy, and I'm certainly not laughing at the tragedy. I'm just saying that we have to recognize that South By and all the crowd control issues that accompany it, it's no different than dealing with a Super Bowl or a papal visit or a World Cup or any of those things, or the Olympics. You know, I'm not surprised that they've had to readjust, but I do think some of the rhetoric regarding the unofficial events, I think some of that's been unfortunate.
Yeah, because it's like you have smaller mom and pop bars that are on the outside who have like the opportunities, like with all these people in town, to kind of maybe it's like throw an event, it's like with a sponsor, and it's tempting to up their bar sales that week if they're on the outskirts, it's like of the whole South By focus, and you can't fault them, it's like, for wanting to do something.
Well,
it's sometimes
there's not even much of a commercial component to it. I mean you look at the number of really, really great unofficial shows that happened throughout town during South By Week. How many of those bands went on to become like official South By fixtures? How many of them came to town because somebody reached out to them and said, I want to do a show with you, and then later on South By booked them?
Yeah.
That's happened over and over and over again. So
what was it, like Mess With Texas, it's like Fader Fort and some others. It's like, you know, they're basically, it's like they're not there anymore, right?
Well, I don't know. I don't know that Fader Fort isn't there anymore.
Well, at least it's like their normal lot that they would use. It's like it's getting chopped up. It's like a condo now.
Okay. So. Well, I mean, I was thinking more of like smaller events, but rest in peace, Fader Fort. Absolutely. let's have a moment of silence for all those great times we were at the Fader Fort watching Crystal Castles and we had our
small
our,
bands like yeah, Crystal Castles.
watching the Crystal Castles and MC Scat Cat and all the other great performers that embraced the Fader Fort stage. Over the Fader Fort era is now over. The day the music died, et cetera. So.
Well, I guess it's like in a smaller thing and something that I was curious about. It's like on your aspect of is it's like right now we're doing a free week here in town. It's like we're about the first two weekends it's like of the year and the days in between bars get together. It's like and have no cover. It's like and they stack the bills. It's like with lots of local talent.
Okay, let's stop. Wait a second. Bars get together.
Well, let's call
a spade a spade, okay? Free week began at Emo's.
Right.
Okay, Graham Williams should get the credit for being the guy who, you know, free week trademark, much the way South By are protective of their trademark. Graham Williams should be going around to every one of these other places and slapping them with a cease and desist order and commanding that they start charging people money to get in. Otherwise, he's gonna sue the heck out of them for copyright infringement. I'd like to see that. I'd like, you know what? I'm not a lawyer, but I'm willing to pretend to be one for a couple of days. I will represent Graham for free in that regard, just so I can serve the swan dive with papers.
Well, so
lots of papers, lots of old copies of the Statesman, all stacked up, tied in the rope. Going to bring them down to the swan dive tonight.
So it's less of maybe it's like a conscious effort of bars just like getting together, it's like as I inferred, it's like to do this, but more like people jumping on us like on this bandwagon.
Yeah, I mean, people are jumping on a bandwagon, and I mean, it's great. We got this town where people are already allergic to reaching into their pocket to go to shows, and now we've given them another 2 weeks, but they don't need to pay to get into shows.
That's been the argument. It's like that free week does more harm than good because it gets people like into the custom of seeing things for free as opposed to.
Well, it depends. I mean, it does some of the bars, obviously does them some good. And I'm sure there are bands who feel that their profile was elevated by playing like a great free week show in front of a ton of people. I can't tell you that's never happened.
Right.
You know, my feeling about free week is this. If you have a venue that has spent the entire year programming great local music, sometimes at a loss, taking chances on newer, weirder bands who wouldn't have gotten anywhere else to play, really trying to cultivate, incubate, if you will. You know, they hit that rough patch the beginning of January when it's cold, nobody wants to go out, got the post-holiday hangover, da da da. You know, this is essentially you're throwing a de facto benefit for a club that's helped your band and your scene, your community and your friends. It's a club that employs your friends. How many Austin musicians work in some of these places?
Right.
So, you know, you're giving they've given back to you all year long. So for 10 days in January, you're going to give back to them. I think that's totally cool. I have no problem with that whatsoever. But let's say you're talking about another venue that has not spent the entire year helping out town, a venue that pretty much, you know, it's kind of like South By style. They suddenly start booking shows for that one big splash. You know, they take a hefty cut of the door money for themselves the other 355 nights of the year. They mostly book terrible stuff that's interchangeable because they can't tell the difference. Why, if you're a band, why do you want to throw them a benefit? Yeah. Why do you? What's the compelling reason to do them a favor? What have they done for you? I mean, if all they're doing is they're giving you a stage to play on, you could probably do a little bit better. Yeah. You could wait till after Free Week. You don't have to play every Free Week show. But you know, again. If someone's in demand and someone asks them to play, I think people in this town know that you know, most of the time bands are going to say yes. Bands in this town have a very hard time saying no.
They like to play.
Yeah. It's fun. And then the whole notion of, well, who am I playing for and why? Some people think about it, absolutely, but not everybody.
Yeah.
And I wish it was a question that people asked every now and then. You don't have to be super hardcore about it. You don't have to draw this line on the sand that says, this is the only venue I will ever play at as long as I live, because new places come along. People change business practices. You can have a dialogue with a club owner or a booker, and you can say, well, hey, why don't we do this instead? What do you think of this idea? I mean, you can have a conversation rather than just trashing them on Facebook. Why not have a conversation? Why not have a cup of coffee to discuss it? I remember clearly when the guy from the Swan Dive wrote to me last year and said, why don't we have a cup of coffee?
There you go.
Why don't we have a cup of coffee? I know where you live. I know what you look like.
that last part is like a little iffy, but
yeah. I mean, sure. Yeah, let's get coffee. Sure. So yeah. I mean, Free Week. I think Free Week's a mixed bag. You know.
But you know, it's like some bars, it's like I've elected out of it because it's like they say it's like, you know, there's a lot of bands here in town and it's kind of hard to book, and we rely on booking. So it's like we're going to forgo Free Week. We're going to charge like $3 at the door. And that way we have something that we can guarantee the bands, not just bar sales.
Are you referring to Vegas?
Yeah. Hotel Vegas.
I think that's fine.
Yeah. You know? They have to do what they need to do.
I mean, look, I mean, Vegas is so packed. Most weekends and so many weeknights, they've already demonstrated that tons of people are willing to pay $5 or $6, many of whom don't even watch the band.
Yeah.
So, I mean, yeah, if you have a space where you can get a couple hundred people to pay $6 who aren't even watching the band and they're going to drink all night, why would you want to let them all in for free? Well, I have no, that's fine. Good for Vegas.
I was just curious because it's like I did remember from last year there was like this conversation that came up. It's like between bands, it's like, you know, and yeah, you're right. It's like, you know, if a club is mainly known, it's like for touring artists, this one time it's like where they just happen to book bands and they're asking them, it's like, to do it for no cover, maybe a portion of the bar sales, does seem a little like a short shrift.
Well, look, I mean, I don't think a portion of the bar sales is bad. I'm just saying like paying nobody anything.
Right.
In a portion of the bar sales, that's not terrible.
Okay.
That's not unjust. I'm just saying it's like
there's stories of bands playing for free, and it's like, which is kind of a pseudo pay to play.
There's many bands playing for free. I'm just saying if you're playing for free, it's worth asking, who am I doing this for?
Yeah.
Who am I doing? Are they doing me the favor, or am I doing them the favor, or are we doing each other the favor? I think it's worth asking those questions.
Well, I just want to say thanks right off the bat, because it's like we started with the idea of like doing this just like for about 20 minutes. It ended up being a lot longer than that, but it's been a really great conversation and education. What's next for yourself? It's like, and it's like, are you anything coming up? It's like with Matador or 12XU? Is there South by is coming around the corner?
I mean, Matador has a lot of big, exciting records coming out this year, and 12XU has a lot of big, exciting records coming out this year. And I'm probably gonna be moving to San Antonio.
Really?
Because it's not. I'm kidding.
I was like, yeah, you know, I lived there for 15 years.
I love San Antonio. I just want to beat South by to San Antonio. I want to get to San Antonio before South by does. So they can. You know what? I'll be doing many of the same things this year that I was doing last year with many of the same people. I mean, I could get all pluggy on you, but that's why I have a high powered publicist on retainer for both labels. So.
You know, we didn't even talk about air traffic controllers. It's like, is that still like a going concern for you? It's like playing air traffic.
Yeah,
controllers?
It's definitely a going concern. I'm very concerned. I'm super concerned. We're playing Beerland tomorrow night with Bloody Knives, who are totally great. And I think our next show after that is 2 weeks from Friday at Cheer Up Charlie's with Coma and Algiers and James Arthur's Manhunt.
Yeah.
And Popper Burns and Ringo Death Star. It's Coma and Algiers record release night. But yeah, you know, air traffic controllers continue to redefine uh, the uh, the saying, they don't know when to quit.
Any recording possibilities with y'all guys? It's like, owning a label, there's like this assumption, but
I know, we've it's been a couple of years since we had anything out. There's supposed to be a cassette on Bada Bing sometime later in the year. But beyond that, I mean, there's an eighth album that if I ever get around to finishing the artwork, it'll come out eventually. But you know, I mean, the between you and me, the demand is not keeping me up at night. I don't have a lot of people banging on the door screaming, "Where is that new Air Traffic Controllers album?" So I can kind of take my time with it. I can kind of be leisurely about it. It's not like it's not like we're waiting for it's not like that Guns N' Roses record that's been delayed for did that finally come out?
Oh yeah, Chinese Democracy. Yeah, it wasn't
Damn.
That good.
Okay, well now they've upped their game. It might
still be another decade before their next release though.
But, yeah, you know, some of these bands are not perfectionists the way I am. Some of these bands are just not. I mean, I think a lot of people in town, they could probably take a tip from me when it comes to just like really, really caring about just getting the recording absolutely right and the artwork absolutely right, and then proofreading everything 8 or 9 times and then throwing it all away and starting over again. it's hell being a perfectionist, as I'm sure you know. As I'm sure you, having heard your program, I'm sure you know what it's like.
Yes, it's like this whole past hour.
Being a perfectionist is absolute. It's hell on your friends and your family, and that's why I don't have any.
Well, my thanks. It's like Gerard Crossley. It's like for his time. It's like Gerard Crossley is like his co-owner. It's like of Matador. Also, it's like he has like the local Austin label or. Based in Austin, label 12XU.
That's an international record label, Tracy.
International,
it's a big international record label. Thank you.
And you can read his writings. It's like on his blog, Can't Stop the Bleeding, can'tstopthebleeding.com. And as we started the program, it's like he's one of the people that you probably should follow. It's like on Facebook, just it's like for just you learn something new. It's like you hear something funny every single day.
MySpace.com, Tracy. It's coming back. Check out my MySpace profile. It's hot stuff.
Well, thank you, Gerard. I appreciate your time.
All right. Thanks for having me.